Welcome to the Lovejoy Hour, sponsored by Cooker, 100 degree boiling hot water straight from your kitchen tap. As you know, mine also does filtered water and sparkling filtered water too, both chilled. It's a great bit of kit. If you can afford one, I'd get it. I absolutely love mine. For more details and to look at the models, go to cooker.co.uk. And also, this podcast is sponsored by Unthin, a new hair loss treatment. I've been using it for about 4 months now. And do you know what? I think it's working, though I'm still pretty bored. So I don't know. But I tell you what, now is the time after about 4 months that it's supposed to really start growing back. So if you're not sure, just keep watching me on telly and you'll soon see if it works or not. It's just as easy as that, isn't it? But there is no taking pills involved in this treatment. That's why I like it. It's a lotion you apply every morning and every night. It's as simple as that. If you fancy giving it a go, use the code LOVEJOY10. And get the first month for £10. So go to unthin.co.uk and use the code LOVEJOY10. That's the number 10. And you get the first month for just £10. So today's hour, I'm curious about time and I'm curious about how to manage it. Joining me is Oliver Burtman to discuss this. Oliver is a journalist and a writer, and he's written a book called 4,000 Weeks, which is the average time you're alive for. Now, I read a lot of books, as you know, for this podcast, and recently a few of them had quite a huge impact on me. This one has definitely done that. I've struggled with time all my adult life, and reading this book has not only shed some light on my problems, it's also turned the volume up on my problems too. Anyway, let's meet him. Here's Oliver Burke. Afternoon, Oliver. How are you?
I'm doing very well. How's it going? Thanks for asking me to do this.
Yeah, no, it's good. As I say, your book is I read your book before Christmas, actually, a few months ago. And it's interesting because I was trying to remember it. Normally, I sort of read a book and then I do the podcast straight after. So, you know, I read the book and thought, I've got to interview Oliver because this book has had such a huge impact on me. And I thought, rather than reread the book, I thought what I would do is try and pick up on the things that I remembered from it most. And the three aspects, which I'm sure we'll go through on this, is being busy is regarded as important. And I've thought for a long time that that is crazy, that that is regarded as so highly in our society. I spend the whole of my life planning for the future rather than living for now, which you talk about a lot in your book. Part about being I'm sure we're going to get through all these, by the way. The part about being a parent and spending all your life trying to make your children good adults for the future rather than enjoying them as a child. And one of the best ones, and one of the ones which I'm sure I'm not remembering this correctly, is when you tell me that I'm insignificant, and
not you specifically,
but that actually really, honestly, Oliver, it really helped. It was like, oh yeah, right, okay, I am insignificant. We'll go through all those, but let's start by finding out a little bit about you. What's your background and why did you write this book?
My background is mainly as a journalist. Work-wise, wrote a column for The Guardian for many years called This Column Will Change Your Life, about psychology and productivity and self-help and all this stuff. In a way, I think this book is like the result of trying out, you know, hundreds of productivity systems and time management techniques and concluding that none of them were going to bring me the salvation that I was seeking. Definitely, this book is a book of, you know, advice that I need to hear, and it's the sort of product of working through my own issues. So you know, all these things are things that I've really found to be a struggle myself, I guess.
Yeah, and I think the thing is with it is it's an adult problem, I believe, because as a child, I don't think my life was structured: go to school holidays, play football, have some clubs, you know, Christmas comes around once a year, takes quite a long time, and then my birthday to look forward to. Then suddenly you go into adult life and it's my decision what to do with my time. And the one bit of your book that really really hit home with me is the idea that loads of microwaves have 2 seconds left on them because we can't even wait 3 minutes to do something. And that was me, and I'm trying my hardest not to do it because time now becomes so valuable and we're so impatient. And that feeling, I'm reading that, was like, I was there, road rage, everything. I need to get there. Why are you going in front of me? It's that I can't think of what the correct word is, but the desperation that time is running out.
Yeah, I mean, I think that maybe it's worth sort of trying to say what I think is like the really big picture in this book that all these things are examples of. I mean, I feel like on some level that we don't necessarily admit to ourselves and that might need, you know, years of therapy to unearth, we really don't want to face the consequences of being finite and only having limited time before we die. Not just because like death itself is scary, but because we don't want to feel like we have to make tough choices, right? That if you decide to marry somebody, you can't for the time being anyway marry anyone else. That if you decide to spend your day doing this thing, you're going to be neglecting that thing. Like all these troubles with time that we encounter, I think ultimately because we don't want to accept that we're like limited. And so all these different things we do, like try to go faster and faster, make ourselves busier and busier, live for the future instead of the present. I think I can sort of argue that they're all ways to try and convince ourselves internally that we're not limited. And so I'm hoping to encourage people in the book, I think, to like sort of admit defeat, face reality, not because you should then live in a state of despair about how little you can do, but sort of precisely because you have to do that defeat or that surrender if you're then going to spend your time on a few things that matter instead of running around like a headless chicken or whatever, you know, trying to do everything.
Yeah, let's talk about the bit that made us laugh at the top, is the fact that you said I was insignificant. You know, there's very few William Shakespeare's and Isaac Newton's and things. But it gave me relief that the point. What is the point you're trying to make in the book about me and the rest of us being insignificant?
Yeah, yeah. This chapter that specifically attacks you as insignificant. I'm trying to make the point. You know, if you think about what a human life is in the context of the history of humanity, let alone the context of the history of the cosmos, right? It's just mind-bendingly nothing and tiny. And for all sorts of reasons, we have a tendency to sort of take ourselves too seriously in this position, to sort of think about the world as world history as having like led up to our lives or something. Even people who are not kind of like megalomaniacs and narcissists, I think it's just a natural human bias. And this leads to all sorts of, it's kind of paralyzing, right? If you think that a meaningful life has got to be one where you change history for hundreds of years to come, or if you think that like doing a creative job only counts if it's as good as the greatest, if your output is as good as the greatest geniuses in history, all this sort of stuff, it's kind of paralyzing. I find that when I think about the fact that the decisions I make today will be completely irrelevant to anybody in 100 years time, that isn't like, some people think that's a recipe for despair. I think that's a recipe for like, so go on, take the bold choice, take the risk, do the thing that you've been sort of holding off from, because the stakes are kind of low, so you might as well to have a go. And then it sort of relates also to this thing that I think there's a strong tendency we have to think that like a meaningful life has to be an extraordinary life, or you have to do really unusual things, or be really famous, or be really rich. And, you know, I don't think those are illegitimate goals, but you don't want to be using a definition of the meaning of life that kind of rules out all sorts of more mundane things, like, you know, raising kids well, or, you know, having a nice garden, or, you know, contributing in some way to the good of your local community. Like, you don't want to, the fact that these things don't put a dent in the universe, to quote Steve Jobs, that shouldn't be a reason to not want to do them if they matter to you.
Yeah, I was just having a chat with someone the other day about Jeremy Beadle, and we were saying that when no one's mentioned Jeremy Beadle for, you know, sadly he's dead, seemed like a nice guy, never met him, but at one stage he was huge in our country on TV. Everybody knew him. No one talks about him anymore because even though he made it, he was one of the massive stars in the 80s. Mm-hmm. Doesn't matter now, a few decades later. I think it was a Confucius who said, every man lives twice, isn't it? Once when you're, you live one life and then your second life starts when you realize you can die or something. Yeah. I've done such a bad version of
Confucius. I think it is. We each have two lives. The second begins when we realize we have only one. I think that's it. Yeah. I'm not sure it really is Confucius, but whatever.
Isn't it? Oh, it was always online as that. But yeah, it's fascinating that. And as I say, it gave me a lot of peace because people often talk about and self-help books. I've read millions of them. That's why I started this podcast. And I get a lot of people on to talk about life on this. They always say you've got to find your purpose in life. Now, you don't sit around and think your purpose in life is to, you know, I don't know, help with the local charity fair or something. You think, I've got to find a cure for cancer, mm-hmm. or I've got to be the biggest star on the planet and then use my voice to help, you know. And so that's the problem, isn't it? As humans, we sort of are finding a purpose in the mundane is possibly not what we're programmed to do.
Right. I mean, I think it's also a matter of like seeing through various kind of pressures you might feel from other people or from your own personal weird hang-ups or whatever, through to something that feels like you're doing something that you sort of came here for in a way. And that can totally be high profile. You know, we need some people to feel passionate about trying to cure cancer. I just think that the way we often go about it, the sort of cultural message we absorb, means that you have to only cure cancer or be one of the most famous people in the world or something, and it doesn't count if you're doing something else. So, and again, you know, if you take that and then you add to this fact that most of the big decisions that you face in life that seem so weighty in the moment will mean nothing in a century, I think they both sort of add up to a kind of, it's liberating, right? You can, it leaves you a bit freer to just sort of do the thing that you're, that gnaws at you, not necessarily a purpose in some grand sense, but you know, something that gives you pleasure and hopefully makes a small difference to people around you.
Did you struggle with time, and do you still struggle with time?
Oh yeah, totally. I mean, as I write in the book, I was a totally paid up sort of productivity geek, right? There's no system of organizing your schedule or your to-do list and all this stuff that I haven't tried. And I had this kind of epiphany when I was like, hang on, I've done this, I've tried hundreds of these and it has never worked. And that was when I started to understand like what my hidden emotional agenda had been. I think that's the important thing, right? It's like, there's nothing wrong with organizing your day following the Pomodoro technique or, you know, getting things done. I'm sure you're all familiar with some of these methods. The problem is thinking that if you follow the right ones, you're somehow going to get to this magical place where you never have to disappoint anybody, where every ambition you've ever had, you'll get time to do, where you can answer every email that your boss sends you, and you know that, where you can just be this kind of perfectly optimized human being, which is kind of like, you know, it's because you don't want to feel the discomfort of what we actually are, which is limited humans who have to make choices. And so that was a big moment for me. I still totally do struggle with time because I think it's sort of probably just inescapably human to do so. But I sort of see what I was up to then, and I think what lots of people are up to when they're pursuing these kinds of self-help techniques. So it's a bit easier not to go weeks down a rabbit hole of something like that because you sort of, I've kind of seen through the illusion a bit, I suppose, about.
Yeah, and time is a sort of modern phenomenon, really. I mean, it's only a few hundred years, I suppose, we've been working an accurate time. I suppose my granddad's era, he's not alive anymore, but I suppose they didn't have a lot of options and choices, which is, I was sort of saying, as a child, we don't have. I was doing a jigsaw. I bought my daughter a jigsaw of the world the other day because, you know, I like the idea that my daughter is going to be exploring the world, as we like to think as parents our children will do. And she went, oh, well, how many of the continents have you been to? And I looked through, and obviously I've not been to Antarctica. Most people haven't. But then I looked at South America and I thought, I've not been to South America. And I had this massive anxiety, like, oh my God, I haven't been to, what sort of person am I? I have the keys to the world. I have a passport. I'm British. I have a passport. We're privileged. And I haven't been to South America. I need to find time to do that. That's what I need to do. And it's just this thought process that we're constantly finding things that we should do, fear of missing out. We should have been there. I should be windsurfing. I should be this. I should be throwing myself off a cliff. I should be climbing. It's like there's too many things to do now.
Yeah, totally. And I mean, it's really interesting, isn't it? Because in days gone by, when those options weren't feasible for almost anybody, they didn't torment us. And so now it's so much more feasible for so many more people to do so many more things or to have so many more experiences. But the big irony is that it basically guarantees that you're going to miss out on most of them, right? It's just maths. If you are living in a world where air travel and digital connectivity and all the rest of it both sort of tells you about, you find out about things, and they're also more practical for you to do them, then you're very swiftly going to get to a point where you know about and feel like you want to do many, many more than you ever could do. Which again is this, I think what's required is this this attitude of surrender, right? It's not I'm going to avoid missing out on things, it's that I'm going to see that I'm definitely going to miss out on almost everything. And that's a very sort of empowering kind of defeat, I think, because once you've accepted that, you can be like, okay, so what of the million things of which I'll get to do a tiny handful in my life, what would be one that I really would like to do, like this year, this month, instead of this, right, yeah, this constant anxiety of trying to fit more in, when you're drawing from an effectively infinite supply of things to fit in. So, like, good luck getting through that.
Yeah. You mentioned a bit earlier, and I think we should go into a bit more detail, of this obsession we have of, oh, well, I definitely have this, of planning to the future, for the future. You know, if only I can get another £10 million, not that I've had the first 10 million, by the way, but if only I could get £10 million, then my future would be great. If only I could get that one more job, if only I could do that, if I buy that car, if I do this constant living for the future rather than living for the now. Now, obviously, as humans, we have to plan for the future. You do need to pay your mortgage and find out ways of doing that, etc. But the idea that I'm always, and I've had this ever since I left my parents' house, I've had this. Actually, when I lived there, I probably still had it, where I'm always thinking, if I do that, it'll be good for the future. If I do that, the idea that I'm resigning from that as well, and I'm sort of saying, well, I'm not going to live for the future anymore. I'm going to try and live, very Buddhist, isn't it? But try and live for the present. I think there's a key in that to stop thinking about, I could be dead in the next year, yet I'm planning for 10 years' time. It seems mad that we all do that so often.
Yeah, no, and I mean, if it's any consolation, I think it's essentially universal, and the economy and the culture all sort of push us in that direction. And as you say, right, I mean, I don't think this makes the case for not doing any planning for the future, and I'd be a hypocrite anyway because I can't live that way. Maybe some Zen masters can. The thing to see there is like, again, I'm sort of getting all sort of psychoanalytic about it or something, but it's like seeing what's going on in your unconscious when you do that and why it is appealing to live in that way. Because you always get to say that the moment of truth is in the future, right? You always get to say, like, okay, I'm doing this now, but the time when I'm going to have to, like, make the risky decision or try the career that I don't know if I'll succeed in or take the risk, you know, that's always in the future. And there's a great quote that I use in the book from John Maynard Keynes, The Economist, about how people who live this way, they don't really love their cats, but only their cat's kittens. And actually, they don't really love the kittens, but the kitten's kittens, and so on forever to the end of catdom, as he puts it. And the reason they're doing that is because they're trying to, it's a sort of a way to feel immortal, right? It's hard to convey this maybe, but it's like, if the moment of truth is always in the future, you never need to accept that, like, no, this is it. Life is not a dress rehearsal. If you're going to do the thing, you've got to do the thing today. So it's really comforting to work in this mindset, but it's also really frustrating, right? Because you're always like, well, when do I get to the bit that is good? And then, you know, if you do get to bits of that, I remember very plainly, you know, being in deep in this mindset for my university exams, thinking that it was a matter of life or death that I did really well in them, doing really well in them and enjoying that for like 3.5 hours or something. You know, it's like the joy of a goal achieved when you've only been living for the future is really short-lived anyway, and then you're on to the next one. It's like, what have I got to do for the following year or years? And so, yeah, I mean, I love this quote from Joseph Goldstein, the meditation teacher, who says that we forget that a plan is just a thought. It's cool to have a plan because it helps you navigate your actions and select the right things to do from your to-do list. But the idea that it's something with some kind of magical power to bring about fulfillment, or that you get to control the future, or, you know, all it is just a statement of your intentions for right now. And that's great, but like, don't overinvest in it.
It's controlling the future. I think that's the key there, is we think if we can do this, we can do, you know, we do two or three things, we get the financial backing, we manage to get enough money in the bank and we've got the job we like, we are going to be able to sit on that boat and never work again. We can choose to do what we want. And that right. never exists. And there's that old parable, isn't there, of the guy who's working really hard to sit on the boat. I can't be bothered to go into it. Everybody knows it. But just getting back to the football one, getting back to the thing about the kittens, I always think that with football is you've got always the pundits are going, if there's any young kids watching, this is the way you should be playing for da da da, and this will be great for the young. And I'm thinking, all right, so I'm waiting to watch the young kids play, not this lot here. Right. They're playing for the young kids, yeah. And then when they, because I've watched so various generations, you know, they're always playing for the young kids, the young, you know, and it seems to be this ever-ending cycle of youth that we're supposed to be waiting for to come through, rather than watching the talent we've got on display at the moment.
Professional sport is such a in general, it's such a fascinating topic here, because you're taking the sort of definitional activity that one does in the moment, which is play, and then turning it into something that is, you know, absolutely definitionally all about the future generations, as you say, or about players earning money, or about creating franchise, whatever. You know, I'm the wrong person to talk about this for a very great length, but like, it's so interesting because it is that present moment activity of just being absorbed in a game, turned into this kind of whole instrumental future oriented thing. Yeah, fascinating.
Exactly. Now we talk. There's what the one expression that I always love is the work life balance, which none of us have achieved no, ever. And then you add kids into it as well, and then there's absolutely no chance on getting the balance right. That's a real problem for us, isn't it? Because that expression, work life balance, gives all of us anxiety.
Yeah, totally. It's funny, isn't it? Because like the word balance implies serenity and being zen, but because there's just too much to do, because you could spend your entire waking life getting better and better at being a good parent, or your entire waking life getting more and more successful in your work or pursuing hobbies, you know, ad infinitum. Balance, like what it tends to feel like it means when you see and read people sort of recommending that you cultivate it, is that you've got to find a way to like be 100% as a worker and be 100% in the rest of your life, which is 200%, right? It's not gonna happen. And I think it's clear to me that there have been phases in anyone's life where imbalance is a is a totally legitimate thing. I think if, you know, a young professional adult wants to mainly just work for a few years because they are into the work that they're doing, that's kind of a noble thing. And if somebody with small kids wants to do everything they possibly can to sort of, you know, what's the word I'm looking for, to sort of not do the minimum, I guess, in their work, then I think that's also totally probably a wise strategy. So, you know, balance maybe is something that you can cultivate over seasons of a life, but the idea that at any one moment you're going to be giving your all in so many domains, I think that is probably just a recipe for stress.
Yeah, with work, there's things happen in fashions, and I remember all my friends in the music industry when I first sort of met them, they would pride themselves on lack of work. You know, I'm just so good, I'll find a band, make a gazillion pounds out of that band, and spend most of my days lying on the sofa in my bed with a hangover. And then streaming happened and they went, oh shit, I've got to work here. And suddenly they were absolutely, you know, busy as hell, and it became very fashionable to work every hour God sends them. But that's happened in a lot of industries. Busy became very fashionable. I'm not sure whether it still is or not, but busy, you were perceived as being successful if you had no time left for anything and you were busy. And I must admit, when I was during a stage where I was producing Soccer M, a show on Sky Sports, yeah, I was having to work sort of pretty much 6 days a week. And I used to think I was incredible because of that. I had no time to myself. I was always knackered. But I was a young man, so I was able to do it. Now, if you asked me to do that, I'd be all over the place. I mean, busy, big is sort of a fashionable thing to say, isn't it?
Yeah, totally. No, absolutely. And it's like, it's so ridiculous in historical perspective. I mean, like before the Industrial Revolution, certainly you go back in like deep history, like the whole point of being wealthy as an aristocrat or a monarch or whatever, you know, the whole point of that kind of power was so that you didn't need to work like everyone else had to. Ancient Greece, ancient Rome, the sort of the highest goal of life was to spend the day in philosophical contemplation, and work was something that, you know, well, firstly they had slavery, but work was something that if you had to do it, it was sort of an unfortunate necessity. And in many ways, I think the problem now comes for sort of the more fortunate of us anyway, the problem comes because we do have jobs and work that we find fulfilling and that provide some meaning for us, right? So I mean that it's sort of easier to fill a life with that kind of thing. If you obviously plenty of people are busy doing jobs that they wish they didn't have to do, but they haven't bought into it in the same way as, like, you know, I say yes to too many opportunities to do things because I get them and because I love doing them, and I'm sure it's like 10 times as true as it is for me that it for you. And so it's difficult, right? Because like to find more sanity in that would require sort of saying no to things that you actually would really like to do.
Do you enjoy your job?
Yes. No, I really enjoy my job, but I also get stressed out by my job and feel like I've got too many things going on in my job. And so, yeah, the fact that I get to sort of think about ideas that interest me and then communicate them to other people is just amazing. But it doesn't, but if all you do is invest in that, then it'll just, what am I trying to say? You've got to get better at putting boundaries up around it as well. And that's hard if the thing you do is something you enjoy. Because then it's, you have to make the sacrifices is felt in a way that it isn't if you're not sort of into what you're doing.
What does it feel like when someone like myself, because I can actually communicate back with you, I was totally overwhelmed by time. I still am. And it's something that has consumes me on a daily, weekly, yearly, monthly basis. You know, Christmas comes around, you know, used to come around every year. Now it comes around once a month. You know, it's one of those classic thing. I think I've stolen that off somebody else, that same. But
I've never heard it.
totally overwhelmed by time. And then I read your book and I get you're starting to give me a bit of relief and some, I'm able to analyze time. I'm resonating with the stuff you're writing. How does that feel that you've written something that is actually having an impact on another human?
It literally is the best part of it. I mean, obviously, it's like, it's just, it's, and what's so interesting to me about that is it's like, it's one-to-one where the value is. So it is a conversation like this, or some emails that I've received from individual people. And it's curious because the economy that we've built for sort of talking about ideas like this, writing books, podcasts, whatever, you know, is very much, it relies on one to many. It relies on sort of spreading the word to thousands and thousands of people. But for me anyway, the real value comes in sort of a certain sort of one-to-one encounter. I'm interested in how that works in your life, obviously, because you sort of operate at scale and you presumably hear from a lot of people who you don't necessarily have time to have long email back and forths with. But I do think that a lot of value comes from still being open to those individual encounters.
Yeah, well, actually, if anyone does want to contact me, lovejoyhour@gmail.com is the way to do it. And I do every now and then get, it's lovely, and I get emails every now and then which tell me they're listening to these podcasts and they're helping them in some way, or they're enjoying them and they find them meaningful, because I interview a lot of people like yourself. And also social media, to be honest with you, I don't always go and look on there, but often people direct message me and I can read some of them on things. And it's always lovely when I get a nice bit of feedback, because, you know, I don't know what people make of them when they're listening, but then it's lovely when you get a nice bit of feedback. The other day I should post some of these. I went on to iTunes and there was some there's some horrific comments, but there were some lovely comments on there as well, where people actually really enjoying it, you know, because I'm not scared to ask the stupid questions, because, you know, I'm not an academic, and I think that's the beauty of talking about issues like this often, and I think that's what people like, and that comes across. Let's talk about parenting quickly, because I did think that was a really important part of it. I've got three kids and there's a massive age difference between the twins, who are 19, and my little one, who is 8. And my parenting has changed totally from the twins to the 8-year-old, with understanding that with the twins, every minute was trying to educate them and do something for them to set them up as an adult. With the younger one, I'm a bit more like, should we just have some fun?
Yeah.
And you talk about that in the book, and it's very relevant, because a lot of us think that being a parent, the only bit of it is to prepare, which is an important part of it, is just to prepare them to be adults, and that's all we do. They're called helicopter parents, I believe.
Yes, that's right. It's so interesting to hear you say that contrast between your approach to your kids. I have a 5-year-old son, and he doesn't have any older or younger siblings, but I'm hopeful that leaving it as late as I did in life to become father will slightly replicate some of that that sort of extra level of chill in the approach, because I feel like I've got past some kind of anxious commitment to overachievement in my own life, and so maybe I won't burden him with quite so much of that. But as I write in the book, you know, yeah, I think we're all sort of locked to some degree or another in this future fixated mindset, where like the point of all choices that you make as a parent is whether you're sort of building a better adult for the future. I was really struck, because part of the inspiration for this was some writing that the New Yorker writer Adam Gopnik did on childhood and parenting, where, you know, he sort of points out that when you ask a question like, you know, whether there's a question about whether doing lots of maths homework at a young age, say, or something, is useful or not for a future person. Will it lead them to be brilliant and successful, or will it lead them to be really sort of overly obsessed with work and stress? But that's only one of the questions, what it leads to in the future. The other question is whether doing lots of maths homework is a good way to spend that afternoon of a childhood. And for some kids, it might totally be, but for others, it might not be. He makes the point about, you know, violent video games. There's a huge, very controversial debate about whether playing violent video games makes people violent in future. But even if it doesn't, that's an interesting question. Is it a good way to spend a chunk of one's childhood playing violent video games? Just in and of itself, you could think that it wasn't, even if there was no reason to believe it was storing up damage for the future. And it's really hard to think in these terms, especially with parenting, right? Because the stakes feel so high. It's like it's the biggest responsibility you ever had, and how can you possibly just sort of relax and enjoy it when it's so important? But, you know, then you learn in little bits slowly that the best way to discharge your responsibility is to be able to, like, just relax into the moment a bit more.
I would say my advice as a parent, and I'm not saying I'm a great parent, by the way, but the one thing that I've learned more than anything else is attention is so important. I always say my little phrase is, if you value something, give it attention. Yeah. And whether you're doing maths or you're playing Lego or you're just running around, you know, chasing each other, all children want is attention. And I definitely suffer from lacking attention with my phone, which I'm having to do ridiculous things like put it in even a different floor on my house. I have to leave it upstairs if I'm going to be downstairs, because there's too much temptation to go and just see if anyone's said anything, or there's another WhatsApp message come through. And I see all parents go through this, you know. You could, and especially these days with work, I can just see if there's an email. I've just got to do, the amount of times I said to my daughter, I've just got to finish this bit of work and then I'm with you. Yeah, it's not, nothing's, I used to work with someone who said, nothing's that important that can't wait a month, Tim, which was really frustrating when I had a business with him. However, I think he's probably right in generally, apart from maybe health things or something. But that gets us nicely onto attention. I like the bit in your book where you talk about the woman who's teaching art, because we struggle to show attention to anything, and yet you tell the story about how she teaches her students.
Oh yeah, just briefly. Well, this is an art historian at Harvard called Jennifer Roberts, who has all her incoming students choose a work of art, painting or sculpture in the area, you know, around Harvard, and where there are lots of museums, and then go and look at it for 3 hours straight. And I did this to sort of put myself through it as well. And she's done it. And her point is that, you know, she knows that this is a crazy amount of time to look at a painting. She doesn't think it's reasonable. But the point is that sort of in a society like the one we live in that is so geared for acceleration and hurry, you actually need to sort of take positive, proactive action to sort of slow down to the time that certain things take. And, you know, we're so accustomed to thinking that things take as long as we want them to take. We're going to make the whatever project we think we can set the schedule. And art is a good example, although I don't think this is confined to like art appreciation, but art is a good example of something that sort of has its own time in it. It's like it demands a certain amount of time to really have its effect, and you don't get to decide that you can look at it in 10 seconds and then move on. And what happens if you do this, I can speak from painful personal experience, is like it's really agonizing for the first hour or so to just look at a painting. You're allowed to sort of take notes, so I did a little bit of that, but then when you sort of get through that discomfort to the other side of it, you literally see things in the painting that you hadn't seen before. I'm not speaking metaphorically. I mean like lines, shadows, fig characters, whatever. You know, that it's like things you would definitely not have seen if you had just, you know, moved on after a couple of minutes. And where I think this is important for things beyond sort of appreciating art is, I think there are all sorts of contexts today where it's kind of a really important, almost like a professional skill, to be able to resist the speed that everything else and everyone else wants to move at. Not just because it's somehow more wholesome or something like that, but because you're actually going to like come up with better ideas, get a better grasp of subject material, whatever it might be. Like, if you can bring yourself to let these things take the time they take, and parenting is obviously full of long stretches of time where it's helpful to be able to like let things unfold. If you try to hurry your 5-year-old out of the house to get his clothes and his shoes on to go out, it's going to take 3 times as long as if you hadn't done so.
A couple of years ago, I did a form of meditation, which was an hour a day. Do what you like, but just sit there with your eyes closed. But you've got to just sit there for an hour. You do it for 30 days. So I embarked on it. And the first 2 days, it was excruciating. The idea of sitting doing nothing for an hour. What then happens, it's similar to your art experiment or experience, is as you go on through the days, your brain gets used to it, or your mind, whatever it is, your conscious gets used to it, and you start relaxing into it, but your brain starts playing out scenarios and you end up craving it, going, I want to go back into that state where I'm just looking at my mind, because I can tell you for a fact, your mind is more exciting than anything on Netflix. I mean, the crap which goes on in your head is phenomenal, and the way it makes you feel, you know, you'll go through sexual things and angry things and happy things. And I mean, it is a phenomenal ride. And every day, by the end of the 30 days, I used to sit down and think, excellent, here I go. I'm going into my little journey here. And I don't think we give our brains time to ever just sit and do nothing. And that goes on to my new theory in life, which is helped by reading your book, is that I think maybe life is about doing nothing, not filling your time, trying to get rid of as much stuff as possible so that you actually have time to, I know you're keen on walking, just do things like just go for a walk, which you'll get much more going for a walk than you will climbing Mount Everest. Maybe not, but you know, like just spending your whole life trying to go, what's the next thing I need to do? I've got to learn yoga or Tai Chi, or I've got to go cooking with someone in South America, or I've got to go and do that. Yeah, rather than do that, I'll just go for a walk around the local park or up the fields or something, or just sit and do nothing is probably the most nourishing way to live your life.
Yeah, agree? Such an interesting... I'm really interested in that form of meditation you talk about. So it sounds like one where the instruction was not to focus on your breath. But
no,
just to,
don't focus. Just focus on... Let your mind roam. Your mind's exciting. Let it free. Let it do what it wants to do. It's really exciting. After saying it today, I think I want to go back and do it again because it was such an amazing experience. Like druggy in the end. It really was.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, I suppose this is getting kind of like semantic in a way, but I wonder if it is really doing nothing, or if we've actually got to if what you're talking about is really doing nothing, or if we've just sort of got ourselves into such a kind of instrumental mindset with regard to time that we think of an activity as nothing if it isn't, you know, getting us somewhere. And so, you know, yeah, I write in the book about hiking. It's not really nothing. It's almost everything, right? It's kind of like full absorption in the moment when it goes well, and I'm not, you know, ruminating about all the emails I have to answer. It's just that it has no particular future benefit apart from some minor, you know, health benefits or something. It's just that it's valuable for itself. Yeah.
In today's world, planning ahead isn't always top of mind, but not having life insurance can leave families facing difficult financial uncertainty during already emotional times. In many cases, loved ones are left managing expenses, debts, or long-term obligations without a clear plan in place. Life insurance is one way to help provide financial security and support when it's needed most. That's where Ethos comes in. Ethos makes getting life insurance fast and easy, and it's 100% online. You can get a quote within seconds, apply in minutes, and even get same-day coverage. There's no medical exam. You just answer a few simple health questions online, and coverage options are flexible with up to $3 million available and some policies starting at around $30 a month. Ethos has also earned strong customer feedback with a 4.9 out of 5-star rating on Trustpilot based on more than 5,500 reviews as of August 2026. Help protect your family with life insurance through Ethos. Get your instant quote today at ethos.com. That's ethos.com. Application times and rates may vary.
I've read a book on this woman who is dying of cancer and old age, though. She was very old, and she was sitting there, and the book was from the from a man's perspective who was helping her, had gone to work in a hospice and was going, she was really moody with him and aggressive, and every night she used to sit and watch Coronation Street, and she would get frustrated with him if he ever did anything whilst Coronation Street on. Shh, I'm watching Coronation Street. It was really important to her. And then after a while, they sort of, you know, as all good stories do, they became closer and closer. And towards the end, she was feeling that she was coming to the end of her life. You know, she was getting more sleepy and more tired. And one day she was watching Coronation Street and he was sitting there having a cup of tea next to her. And halfway through it, she turned to him and said, "That thing's stolen a lot of my life, hasn't it?" And I that really stuck with me in that book, that the TV and our mobile phones, computers and our TVs are maybe stealing our life. Now, my friend's obsession with Netflix, and mine also, but I'm trying to do something about it. We've now got Amazon Prime, Netflix, Sky are doing it, BBC are doing it, Channel 4 are doing it, my TV channel. We've got Disney Plus, we've got Apple TV. All of them are pumping at us, right? These box sets, right? They're great. I mean, they are really good, but they're pumping them at us all the time. And we all sneer at EastEnders and Corrie as their ratings are going down. Yet all we've done is shifted to Ozark and Breaking Bad. You know, it's like, or the 8 hours of Beatles documentary. Yeah. I'm sitting watching the Beatles rather than sitting talking to my family. It's insane where we've got to on it. But we do you think it's that she's right? It's I kind of do that. It's stealing our life. I think TV and film and music, I think they're all really important things. But we can get absolutely obsessed with them, that we actually are not living. All we're doing is going home and going, how many episodes can we do of Ozark tonight?
Yeah, I mean, I think it is a you point to a really interesting point there, right? There's a whole history of, you know, culture writing on the evils of television, but there's also really great, fantastic television that does enrich life. And I'm glad that my life has involved being able to watch The Wire or Happy Valley, you know, rather than not having watched those things. I think the problem is that this is true somewhat of those kinds of media, films and TV, and very true of social media and online content, is that it's like it's not a level playing field. These are they're stealing our attention in the sense that they are sort of designed by lots and lots of very highly qualified professionals to sort of undermine any desire we might have had to do something else, to compel us. It's always been true on some level, going back to like stories around the campfire, right? You keep listening because they've been designed to hook you. But I think it's become sort of absurdly more true in the world of tailored algorithms, because your behavior and your viewing habits and consumption habits are monitored, and then they use that data to make sure that they're giving you more of the things that's going to really grab your individual attention. So it's not a fair fight. It's Tristan Harris, the technology critic, who says that like every time you open up one of these apps, there are 1,000 people on the other side of the screen paid to keep you there. Whereas sort of the reality of a conversation around the dinner table or even a walk in the country, right? They're amazing, but they're not kind of engineered to make sure that there's no boring moment or no unpleasant moment when you'd rather do something else. It's full of those moments. And so you really need to sort of at least be aware of that, I think, and see that in order to sort of bring back a little bit more of conscious choice into the operation. Because, I can't, certainly non-hypocritically, I can't advise anyone else to sort of ban all these things from their lives. I just think, see what's going on and hopefully choose more consciously when to go onto social media for a little while and which TV shows to watch and which ones to not watch and the rest.
I'm intrigued, like though. I've not watched The Wire or Happy Valley, and I understand The Wire's. I did a sketch once on The Wire because I seemed to be the only person left in the world who hadn't watched The Wire. So I did a sketch where I went, you haven't seen The Wire. It was quite a funny sketch. But that I assume that's, I think it's about the drug world set in major
Baltimore.
City in America, Baltimore. It's about drugs, yeah? Is that correct?
Broadly, yes. It then goes on to be like about every layer of the city. It's just about a whole city, basically. But yes.
But if you really wanted to experience those emotions fully, Oliver, couldn't you go and become a drug dealer? I'm sure you have it about yourself. You could go into, I don't know which major city you live near, but you could go to wherever it is, Nottingham or London or somewhere, and you could actually get involved and experience those emotions yourself. I'm not sure what Happy Valley's about. Hopefully not murders, because I don't recommend you go and murder people. But do you know what I mean? It's like, rather than having, I always call it emotional tourism. I don't think that's the right word. I think that means something else. But I always think you tune in to go, oh, look at that. You can actually go and do it yourself and have that
wonderful experience. Yeah, I mean, to some extent, sure. I don't think I'm, what I love about The Wire is that I want to have the emotional experience of being involved in the drugs world. I think David Simon, the creator of The Wire, is a sort of master storyteller, and the experience that I want is to be bewitched by his storytelling for a while. Yeah. The problem is that there are all sorts of other ways to get at my attention and hook me, right? To do with that sort of all these platforms have to sort of grab me and get me to watch things that I don't end up thinking were a few hours in the company of a master storyteller. I'm just like, well, what was the point in that? You know, I clicked on that because it was just designed to be the kind of, you know, attention candy that I would click on. And then you feel like you do feel after you eat a large amount of sweets, you know.
I couldn't agree more with you. And I'm 2 hours into the Beatles documentary, and I love it because I just do quite like looking at them, and I love Breaking Bad, and I love all those things. So, you know, I'm also being hypocritical, but I do beat myself up when I do end up watching crap, and I'm going, why am I watching this nonsense? You know, I watched a great documentary on the Beastie Boys. I learned some stuff from it the other day, and I just thought, well, that was worth it, because I learned a little bit more about life by watching that. So I suppose the coming towards the end of the hour, the conclusion is, I think you say this, it's to try and find out what matters in your life, and then base your time around what matters. Is that correct? Is that what you feel?
Yeah, I mean, I would almost put in a step before that, which is to sort of understand that more things are going to matter than you're going to have time for. So to avoid that kind of talk of like finding your one life purpose and then following it and the universe has a plan for you and all the rest of it, it's like, understand that if your life was three times as long as it's going to be, and you don't know how long it's going to be, you could still, in principle, fill it with activities, relationships, work that felt really important and like they mattered. So it's really a question of choosing among things that matter. I don't need to go into detail, but in the book, I go back to that thing that's in every time management book about fitting the rocks in the jar and how you've got to make time for the big things first. And I sort of make the argument that the problem today is there are too many rocks to go in the jar, right? There's not some magic law of nature that says all the things that you really care about are going to fit into the time that you have available. In fact, there's lots of good reasons why more things feel like they matter than the time available. But again, I think if you sort of squint a bit, you can see that this is liberating, because it means you don't have to set yourself the target in life of fitting in all the things that matter. You just have to set the target in life of spending a good chunk of your time on things that you care about instead of things that you don't care about, to go back to the conversation about some TV shows and some movies. I think it's a question of understanding that, and then also maybe understanding that happiness and meaning are kind of different, and that maybe the ultimate purpose of life is not about feeling cheerful all the time, and that some of the things that really matter don't feel very fun to do in the moment, but they do really matter.
Yeah, a good example of that is health. So sometimes I try and exercise every day, and sometimes I get up to go for my swim or my run or something like that, and I think I don't want to do that. But the flip side of it is I've done it, and then, sorry, not the flip side, the outcome of it is I've done it, I didn't want to do it, but that day I feel amazing because I've done it even when I don't want to do it, because I know that that's how I want to feel. I want to feel fit and that I can take on the run every time. And something I don't, you know, only doing what matters can sound hedonistic, but I don't think you mean that, do you? It's like working out what your values are, what you feel is important in your life, and then making a plan towards that, not just sitting there constantly going, I should be windsurfing in Argentina.
Yeah. Yeah, no, absolutely. And it's almost just more an intuitive thing as well. I quote the psychotherapist James Hollis in the book saying about this question you should ask, whether the path you're on in life enlarges you or diminishes you, right? It's a good question because we sort of all do have a hunch most of the time, I think, about whether a given job, relationship, etc., even if it feels challenging and difficult at certain moments, you know whether you're kind of growing as a person by following that path or not. And so, you know, sometimes you know that you're in a job you shouldn't be in because it's like making your soul shrivel up. But sometimes you know you're in a job that you care about, and maybe it's really hard right now, not happy at all, but you still know that it's like part of growing, yeah.
What do you think happens when you die? You're laughing, but it's...
I think if I'm really, really honest, I think I don't think anything happens.
So then it's kind of all pointless what you're doing with your time anyway, then, isn't it, for you?
No, because I resist the notion that the point has to be something about the future and future generations. Like, the point is here now. I could also make a few kind of like slightly thought for the day-ish points about how we live on in the memories of others and make a mark on other people's lives and all the rest of it. But no, I just don't, I want to resist the notion that whether I spent my life well is entirely defined by somebody 1,000 years from now who has heard of me, because very probably there'll be no such person.
You die twice. Probably Confucius said this. You die once when you actually die, and the second time you die is the last time anyone utters your name, which is why William Shakespeare is still alive and will continue to be for quite some time, I imagine, because people keep uttering his name constantly when it comes to talking about his works. I think I've done a lot of these things looking at self-help books, and you know, I talk a lot about death, and I think a lot about death. My brother died, and so it sort of pushed me towards that way. And a lot of self-help books, including some stuff in your book, as I seem to remember, is when you realize you're going to die, as Confucius said, you start to live. And also there's always that thing that people talk about, which is when you go to a hospice and you speak to people who are... they have their last days, they always talk about human relationships, and I think a lot of time should be spent on that. I think you've alluded to it a bit here. I think that's one of the meanings of life, is actually to, and one of the most exciting things, you know, if you're going to start when you finish this podcast, if you're going to go and start drug dealing in a major city,
it's exactly what I'm going to do. Yeah.
Again, Oliver, it's human interactions are where you get all your buzzes and thrills from, isn't it? It's that is what happens, actually John Lloyd, the TV producer, love him, was on this podcast. I asked him what the meaning of life was, and he said I know what it is, you have to find out yourself. He goes, but I will tell you, sitting in a pub with a few mates having a pint and chatting about the world is pretty damn close to it. And I just thought, that's really valid, isn't it?
Yeah. And it's the same with drug dealing, right? It's the people that make drug dealing really worthwhile.
It's the people's, isn't it? It's a people's occupation. It's like
it's the relationships. It's not the drugs. It's the relationships. Yeah.
I'm a people person. So I got into drug dealing. That is what I found myself doing. Yeah, absolutely brilliant. Yeah, well, listen, I do think your book is absolutely fantastic. I really enjoyed it, and I do actually genuinely mean it. It's opened up a lot of ideas in my head about life, and I thoroughly recommend. By the way, it's called 4,000 Weeks because that's the average time a human lives. Correct?
Yeah. Well,
okay.
Thank you. I really appreciate it. That's really great to hear.
What are you working on next?
It's going to sound coy. I'm still trying to figure out what I'm working on next. I'm just being honest. I'm trying to figure out where this line of thinking goes next. I think the thing I'm really interested in is how do you implement this kind of perspective shift, right? How do you make it stick? How do you understand these ideas about time and then not just be straight back in your regular old grooves in a few months' time? So I'm thinking around that whole question at the moment, especially.
I'm working out how to slow time down. Interestingly, I'll just finish on this, is during the pandemic when we couldn't do anything and go out, overwhelming feeling that I always have of I should be doing things. I should be trying the new restaurant. I should be ice skating. I don't know. All the crap I think about I should be doing was taken away from me because I couldn't do anything. And I started doing this thing where I turned the TV off and sat and watched the fire because I'd read in a book about the caveman's TV was the fire. And I thought I'd give it a go. I've got a gas fire which flickers with flames. And I found that evenings would go really slowly if you sit and do nothing. And I thought it was a way of slowing down time. The more you fill your time, the quicker your life's going to go, the less you do. So I sort of remembered those great summer evenings where you remember when you're a kid and you're just lying in a field, you know, or just messing about somewhere and the sun's coming. They lasted forever, didn't they? And you can still do that as an adult. If you ever go camping, the days last a very long time because nothing happens. As soon as you go on a holiday in a city where there's too much to do, like you go to Tokyo like I did not so long ago, it's like the day's over in 5 minutes. I imagine trying to find ways of slowing down time is a new hobby of mine.
Oh, I like that. I'm going to have to try staring into fire. I love that idea as a way of spending an evening. Seriously.
It really is. No, it's doing nothing is a really good way of doing it, you know. So anyway, Oliver, thank you so much for joining me. It's been wonderful speaking to you. And your book is 4,000 Weeks. I recommend everyone read it if you can, because I think it really opened up a lot of doors in my head for me. So I imagine it would do the same for you. Thanks so much, Oliver.
Thank you. It's been a great conversation.